All right, let's unpack something truly central to our lives today. How our phones, our digital existence. It's subtly yet, well, profoundly reshaping who we are. Our sense of self, our identity, even our mental well-being. We've gone through your sources, and wow, they're packed with some really rich observations on this whole modern digital experience. So our mission today, let's try and extract the most important nuggets from your insights, help you navigate this really complex relationship between technology and self, and maybe explore ways to foster a healthier connection.
Yeah, connecting with that, I mean, a key point that really emerges is just how deeply embedded our phones have become. They're not just tools anymore, are they? They feel like extensions of ourselves. And because of that, this deep dive really touches everyone. Doesn't matter if you're highly technical, just catching up, or, you know, simply curious about their impact, it's huge.
It really is. And,
yeah.
You know, our sources highlight this fascinating observation, particularly from like a T-Mobile business perspective. This idea of a separation of self. Where older generations specifically seem to be investing really heavily in online personas, platforms like Facebook, for instance. What does this separation actually look like in practice? And what are the implications when someone's identity gets so tied up in that curated digital life?
Well, it creates this this fascinating distinction, doesn't it, between our online selves and our real world selves. The validation we seek from our phones, it can kind of take precedence over actual experience or even genuine growth. We've seen specific examples in the sources, right? People make a mistake in the moment, but because it wasn't captured, wasn't posted online, it almost felt like it didn't matter.
Right, like it didn't happen if it's not documented digitally.
Exactly. And that lack of real world consequence, because there's no digital record, can actually stunt, you know, emotional maturity and self-awareness. It creates this feedback loop where virtual approval replaces genuine personal development. And this, well, it nurtures another persona, one that's maybe less accountable to reality. This also ties into that whole pervasive habit of doom scrolling, you know, where the constant online stimuli, the drama, news, politics, criticism, it gives these quick dopamine hits. And that trains our brains to constantly seek that immediate, often pretty superficial reward.
Yeah, that makes sense. It reminds me of something kind of fundamental we seem to be losing track of.
Yeah.
Like, think about navigation. When I was growing up, you know, you'd go buy your maps, lay it down, figure it out. Today it's like, boom, plug in and go.
Instant gratification.
Totally. And while losing map reading skills might seem, I don't know, trivial, our sources suggest a much deeper concern. This erosion of interpersonal communication skills, especially in how we handle conflict or disagreement. What have you observed about this shift, especially when people hide behind screens, you know, the anonymity and the vitriol, and they don't necessarily see the consequences of what's being said?
Well, it highlights how our very modes of communication are transforming, right? Phone calls, emails, they're steadily declining. Text messaging is becoming paramount. And what's striking there is the disconnect. The disconnect of, like, again, still self from how I would react in a real-time conversation compared to how I message in that same exchange.
Yeah, the nuance just gets lost.
Totally lost. Nuance, empathy, immediate feedback gone. But a potential bridge for this maybe could be things like voice memos or speech to text.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, these methods feel more fluid, more personable because they actually convey inflection and, well, a lot more comes through from the actual audio. It restores some of that lost emotional context, allows for more authentic expression, even within these digital constraints.
Okay, so we're seeing this potential loss of crucial interpersonal connection, often without even realizing it. But it's not just what we lose passively, is it? There's this active commercial force shaping our digital lives, often without our full awareness, which brings us to what you call the digital wild west of commercialism and scams. We often hear that saying, if you don't pay for the product, then you are the product. I remember when I was a kid, it was Saturday morning cartoons, basically selling sugar in cereal boxes. We were the product then too, I guess, but it felt like fun. Do you think people today are largely unaware of the business models behind their phones, their apps, like not realizing this isn't just some, you know, goodwill gesture of a phone company?
Oh, 100%. I mean, most people simply don't realize the breadth of the terms and services they're agreeing to. Who has time to read those 20-page legal documents?
Nobody.
Exactly. And this unawareness, that's precisely what's exploited. For instance, from experience at T-Mobile, I've seen sponsored ads for, like, cleaning apps, and they use a fear tactic right in the ad. Your phone has a virus.
Wow.
Yeah. And the insidious insight here is that this exploitation thrives on fear. It turns user anxiety into a commodity. These apps, they often just clog up your phone, collect data, probably sell your data, all while promising a solution that's entirely fabricated. And users often can't tell a bad app from a good one because that initial fear just bypasses logic.
So what can people do? What's the advice for the listener?
Right. For you, the listener, it's critical to, well, first, maybe ask people around you, get advice, or rigorously check the surveys and reviews within the App Store before downloading anything. But most importantly, try to see the signs of it being sponsored. Ask yourself, why are they showing me this? It's probably not for my benefit. Understand the why. They're gaining money somehow.
That's really critical advice, yeah. Especially when so many of these tactics are designed to bypass our rational thought. But okay, recognizing we're the product only gets us so far. The deeper challenge, and maybe our greatest opportunity, lies in reclaiming our inner world, right? Our mental well-being, our self-regulation in an environment that's constantly trying to distract or monetize us. And this leads us to the concept you've explored, what you call biohacking. Using evidence-based techniques, technology, science for self-experimentation and self-regulation. How does this connect to our broader struggle to regulate ourselves in what feels like an increasingly unstable world?
Well, what's fascinating here is that when facing challenges, many of us, we turn to external solutions. Instead of learning crucial internal skills like communication building or therapy, maybe.
Right.
My own journey navigating mental health challenges, it really highlighted a crucial lesson for me. Stability isn't something external that's just handed to you. It's an internal relationship you have to build. Often by developing skills for self-regulation, managing emotional reactivity.
How do you do that practically?
Well, it often involves specific therapeutic approaches like DBT therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy that helps you manage intense emotions, and also things like parts work, which teaches you to understand different internal aspects of yourself, sort of like an internal family system. Both really focus on internal communication through being in the moment, through mindfulness. And there are tools too, like the Healthy Minds app from the University of Wisconsin, which isn't just another mindfulness app, you know? It's scholarly, it's culturally adapted from studies of monks. It integrates ancient wisdom with modern neuroscience to help you actually train your mind.
That sounds promising.
It is. And it brings me to a key question for you, listener. Do you cultivate enough internal space, enough wiggle room, to figure out for yourself how to express yourselves authentically and have the skills to work within yourselves?
That's a really powerful invitation to introspection. And it speaks to this evolving conversation around mental health. I mean, I grew up in an era where even if, say, my grandma had depression, it just wasn't spoken of at all.
Hidden away.
Exactly. Now we're more open, thankfully. But it's true, the brain is such a compelling storyteller. And the stories it tells, they have very real physiologic consequences, don't they? Turning the brain into a chemist, for better or worse.
And that's precisely why the language we use matters so much. It profoundly impacts the stigma around these very real internal experiences. The stories our brains tell us get compounded by the labels society attaches.
Right, the labels.
Yeah, the classification, the labels, while sometimes necessary for study, maybe, they can confuse people, push them away. Take depression, for example. One person's experience can be totally different from another's, yet that single label implies uniformity.
True.
This is why first-person language is so vital. Saying a person with depression rather than a depressed person, it humanizes the experience. I mean, we don't call a person with cancer cancerous.
Right. Well, we don't.
Alfred Adler's philosophy really resonates here. Before you can help somebody, you need to see the world through their eyes and hear the world through their ears. It emphasizes understanding individual perspectives over just sticking on clinical labels. And historically, you know, figures like Abraham Lincoln were actually quite open about their melancholy, what we now understand as depression.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Can you imagine a public figure doing that today in a workplace where we're often expected to just leave our humanity at the door and prioritize productivity?
It's a stark contrast, isn't it? Especially when success often feels so narrowly defined today. Which leads to the next point. Do you think phones and apps, especially social media, contribute to this perception? This idea that success is, well, very narrowly defined, often by job title, material possessions,
yeah.
rather than something more holistic like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, self-actualization.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a key observation here is how deeply our digital spaces reflect and amplify that very narrow definition of success. I like the comparison you drew between Maslow's hierarchy and corporate jobs, because the ideal American dream, as it's often presented online, it can significantly limit people's dreams, pushing them towards this singular, often material-based path.
Yeah, it feels very prescriptive.
It is. We're often taught it has to be all or nothing, good or bad, success or failure, this black and white thinking. It can really cut off potential, inhibit growth. Gordon Allport, in his work on nature prejudice, showed how when our minds get stuck in rigid thinking, what he called nature prejudice, we struggle with life's gray areas. We're always seeking simple answers.
And that makes us susceptible to polarized content online.
Exactly. That's what makes us so susceptible to polarized online content, where nuance is often just gone. And these clear-cut good versus bad narratives dominate. I've constantly struggled with this myself, honestly, but building stability has taught me it doesn't have to be all or nothing. There's always space in the middle. So for you, listener, when you reflect on everyday events, does it have to be a fail? Do you have to label it either a success or a failure?
That's a great challenge for all of us. Really good food for thought. Building on that then, when our perspectives are so drastically different, how do we effectively communicate?
Mm.
Especially when there's this perception of zero-sum thinking, you know, particularly in politics, where it feels like there's almost a perceived consequence to simply having a different viewpoint.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult, isn't it, to connect when people are so entrenched in one way of thinking. For me, personally, to truly communicate, I have to consciously, like, lower my internal walls and wait a second before speaking. Just pause.
Mm-hmm. Take a breath.
Yeah. Then I can try to filter my thoughts through my own experience, boil things down to, okay, this is how I see it just from what we're talking about and the information I have.
That approach, I find, helps bridge my perspective to someone else's. It can draw some light into what feels like a field of disorder, allow for some genuine dialogue.
And what about tools? You mentioned AI earlier, potential and peril. Right. AI. It's fascinating. Positively, it could be a way to just shine facts, just the truth, onto a situation. We've seen examples like Grok, the AI on X, you know, formerly Twitter. It can fact check posts, correct misinformation right there in the feed, offer truly insightful real-time context.
That sounds useful.
It can be. However, AI can also be altered by the people in charge, by the values or weights they deem important to push. My concern is around algorithms being manipulated by commercial interests, basically, going to the highest bidder.
Right.
Or by specific narratives that creators want to amplify. Now, if used properly and with, like, transparent values, AI could truly shine a light through the noise, but honestly is also worth critiquing the 24-hour news cycle, which I believe is equally detrimental to critical thinking because it's so polarized to emotions, not facts.
Yeah, constantly stirring the pot.
Exactly. So for you, listener, it's worth asking, are you just seeking confirmation bias when you consume information, or are you genuinely open to understanding different viewpoints?
Okay. So as we bring this deep dive to a close, wow, what have we truly learned about our digital selves today? We've journeyed through how technology profoundly influences our identity. From the curated online personas we craft to the subtle manipulations of algorithms, and how all this shapes our communication, our mental well-being. The pervasive influence of technology, it really demands our active engagement, doesn't it? Our self-regulation and critical thinking.
It really does. And this raises, I think, an important final question. We've seen political polarization become deeply associated with emotions, which, as we discussed, further drives that separation of self. There's a real risk when community itself is being separated through how many likes you get, how many followers you have. And when the information you intake is so incredibly polarized, it makes it so difficult to find your own authentic perspective when so much external validation is pulling you constantly to conform to prescribed narratives.
So the final thought for the listener is?
Yeah, maybe this. In a world seemingly designed to draw you towards external validation and these simplistic binary narratives, how will you actively seek and protect your own authentic perspective, allowing space for both genuine growth and that sometimes uncomfortable but necessary ambiguity?
It's a powerful thought to reflect on indeed. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive, and we really encourage you, the listener, to continue this reflection long after our conversation ends.